Okay, so today's topic is one that, first of all, is a work in progress. So hopefully you'll be able to help me come to a better understanding of the topic. And it's one that I began thinking about again over Shabbos because of something which I saw, which we'll study together. And that's the topic of the nature of omnipotence. What do we mean when we say God is omnipotent, he's kol yachol, and the like? And I believe this is not just an abstract philosophical question, but it's one that does actually have important ramifications, not necessarily practical ones, but about Nisim and other major matters of Emunah and Hashkafa. So when we were kids, at least when I was a kid, I was told that God can do anything. And that's what we mean by omnipotence. There's nothing he can't do. And yes. And one of the questions that young children like to question and wonder about is, can God create a rock that he can't lift? So before we address some of the sources on this topic, and I don't know of any source that explicitly addresses that, but we could consider what they say. What do you think the answer is? Can God create a rock he can't lift?
Well, there's no way that we can say that God can't lift something.
Okay. So your answer is that he cannot create a rock that he can't lift because it's impossible. So your approach, by the way, is the approach that is certainly the simplest one, and one which I took for a long time. What do you think?
Oh, sorry, I didn't...
What I think you were saying, maybe you could explain yourself better, is that since it's impossible that there exists a rock that God can't lift, then it must be the case that God cannot create such a rock. Now, what we could add to your statement, what you're presuming, is that when we say God is omnipotent, that doesn't mean to say that he can do absolutely everything, or there's nothing he can't do. So what then does omnipotent mean? So
why doesn't it mean that?
Because you said that he can't create a rock he can't lift.
It's a limitation on his ability.
Right.
I have a different answer.
I would prefer addressing it at the core of
okay.
The question isn't a question applicable to God, something
yeah.
like that.
Well, but
even though it's like dodging.
I don't understand why isn't it a question that's applicable. You're answering that we can't know the answer?
It's like have you stopped beating your wife?
What do you mean it doesn't? I don't understand your answer at all.
No,
it doesn't pertain to God.
Right.
Ask the question. Why? What's wrong with asking?
I think you're going to have a good question.
Okay. So I don't understand your answer.
Just like we're asking that question with the frame of reference that we're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Physicality, human beings, this world, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, God is outside of all that.
Uh-huh.
So questions like that may not pertain to him.
Okay, good. We're gonna perhaps develop that idea as well. What did you think?
When I was a child, I asked the question is, can God be at both the same time the irresistible force and the immovable object?
Uh-huh.
And the answer, which I didn't understand as a child until I was old enough to appreciate the words, it's a philosophically invalid question because it's not a valid question because it's almost like a contradiction in terms. To say these two qualities, because he can make the irresistible force, he can make the immovable object, but then you have this contradiction in terms, because it's just not the way logic works.
Okay, well, let's see. As I said, this is a work in progress. I don't know if I have the correct answer, but let's study some of the sources. So the first source I want to consider with you is the Rambam in Mor Nevuchim, Chela Gimel Perek Tet Vav, 3 chapter 15. And he writes, "That which is impossible has a permanent and constant property, which is not the result of some agent."
Oh, you're reading that. Okay. We did this already?
No, we didn't. Okay. Maybe we'll get back to it if we have time.
Mm-hmm.
and cannot in any way change. And consequently, we do not ascribe to God the power of doing what is impossible. No thinking man denies the truth of this maxim. None ignore it, but such as have no idea of logic.
Yes, that's what I mean by philosophically.
Okay, so what's he saying? He's saying that when we talk about divine omnipotence, we don't actually mean that there is nothing that God can do, or even that God can do everything. Rather, I believe what he's saying is that we mean that God can do anything that's theoretically possible. For example, nobody would deny the statement that God cannot destroy himself. Because,
exactly the example
as we
thinking.
Could prove, and the Rambam in fact does prove this, that his existence is necessary. If his existence is necessary, the term necessary means...
A given.
It could not be that way.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's necessary, if his existence is necessary, then he cannot destroy himself. He cannot duplicate himself because his oneness is necessary. It's logically proven. He cannot, according to the Rambam, take on a physical form because his incorporeality is provable. So what do we mean when we say God is omnipotent? It means we could say that God could do anything theoretically possible. But if something is logically impossible, so then God cannot do it. Is that a problem? No. Because it doesn't ascribe deficiency to God. To say that God's...
Deficiency. Okay. I'm just making sure I'm understanding.
Yes. To say that God can't do something like create a table or pick up a table or the like, that would imply deficiency. It's conceivable, it's logically possible to create a table, and therefore if he's unable to do it, so then he's lacking in a certain respect. He's weak, he's incapable. That is problematic. But to say that he can't do something which is logically impossible is not inappropriate, because it doesn't imply any type of lacking, any type of deficiency. So,
I have a hard time just limiting that. A hard time conceiving that we could limit God.
So, what I think we're saying, okay, and I think there's something to your question, but again, if I just had this source, I would have said that this is not us limiting God. But it does raise an issue. So we're saying, okay, it's not us who is limiting God, it's logic that's limiting God. But how could you limit God with logic? So this is a very interesting question. And I guess we'll go back to that first source that we mentioned, that we skipped. And that first source is the beginning of the Rambam in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, where the Rambam writes, Yesod HaYesodos V'Amud HaChachma Leida Sheyesha Matsui Rishon.
This is from the Yan Hilchos.
Yes. He is the cause for the existence of anything that exists. And anything that does exist only exists due to the truth of his existence. The Rav made the following diuk, that what you see here is that there could be no independent power which limits God. And the Rav felt that means even an independent moral or morality, meaning to say that would be something else that exists independently of God and that limits God. And I think to some degree what you're arguing is even if we say that God can't do that which is illogical, so we're saying that there is this independent existence, namely logic, which limits and binds God. And we don't want to do that. I think that's a fair objection. Now,
logic wouldn't exist without human beings.
Maybe, right? Maybe not. If you think that's correct, so then clearly you would agree that logic couldn't exist without God. Now, what I believe the Rambam was presuming, to take a step back, and we'll see others who agree with him, was that logic does exist without human beings. Logic is inherently true. And it's not even a creation such that we would say that there's an external existence that in some way limits God. Rather, logic is simply the truth. And therefore...
All logic that we express is human logic. Now, is our application of logic to arrive at conclusions necessarily applicable to God's, quote, logic.
Good, good. So I agree to your objection. First, I'm going to show you two sources which seem to agree to the Rambam, and then we're going to consider, I think, basically, what is at the root of both of your questions, and we'll get to that.
Okay, so just one point,
yes.
Point of information. Uh-huh. So far, unless I missed it again, mm-hmm. Everything we're talking about is kind of more philosophical in universally than it is Jewishly.
Okay.
And not that there's anything necessarily wrong with that, because Jews are still part of the existence, and mm-hmm. you have to grapple with the same things
yep.
that other people do too. I just want to know whether are we going to be heading in a direction that some part of which becomes uniquely Jewish?
Well, you'll decide at the end.
Okay.
There's a very question that Jewish philosophers in the 19th and 20th century debated, which is there such a thing as Jewish philosophy? There were those who argued that there is no such thing as Jewish philosophy, because if it's philosophy, then it's universal. It's nothing to do with Jewish. Hermann Cohn mm-hmm. had a theory. He argued, at least later in his life, that there was such a thing as a Jewish philosophy. He thought that, for example, the ontological proof for God was the fact that Christians tried to prove the existence of God ontologically and Jews didn't was a reflection.
What is the ontological proof for God?
An ontological.
I know what the word ontological
for, means. For God means that you can conceive of it independently, as opposed to, let's say, a cosmological proof of God, which is that you look at nature and deduce from the existence of nature the existence
okay.
of God. Anyhow, but that's a good question. It's an interesting question, not for tonight, which is there such a thing as Jewish philosophy? But let's,
well,
in terms of your...
Just also, mm-hmm. In terms of the question about logic,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you've spent time with different kinds of cultures,
mm-hmm.
you become aware that not all cultures think alike.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the logic that exists in certain cultures wouldn't be the same kind of logic that
mm-hmm.
exists in other cultures.
So that's a fair point, but it's one that the Rambam would disagree with. And it's one that is indeed even in contemporary philosophy debated. There are those who say that logic is scientific and exists. It might be that different cultures think differently, but logic is something that is definitive. It's true in all. It's absolutely true that if A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C, and whether or not a particular culture acknowledges that is irrelevant. But I think that's part of this question.
Taking a step back, I didn't get a chance to write down what it was that you said was the Rav's interpretation.
The Rav's interpretation was simply, it was in a different context, but that God is the source, is the cause for all existence, and therefore there couldn't possibly be a system of ethics or morality that somehow limited God, because that would imply something that exists independently of God and limits God. Okay, so two more sources, perhaps what we'll call this of the old school thought. One is, here's a passage from the Rashba. Lest you think that this first perspective, that God is bound by logic, as it were, is something that the Rambam would say, a philosopher. So the next source is a Rashba, in page 2, and this is the translation of it. This is from the Tshuvos HaRashba. It actually relates to a topic connecting to last week's Parsha. Last week's Parsha we read about Matan Torah. The Rambam has a unique position concerning what the actual nature of revelation was at Sinai, based off of his theory that prophecy is not possible for those that are untrained. His position is actually quite unclear. But here
I think you touched upon it.
Yes. Here the Rashba is alluding to this point, and he says the following. We'll read the English. There are two types of impossibilities. The first, which is inherently necessary and logical, such as the side of a square equaling or exceeding its diagonal, or an event that is both occurred and not occurred, and many other similar examples. These things are inherently, absolutely impossible, and cannot, and not conceivably possible. So the first type of impossibility is an inherent impossibility, something that cannot possibly be true, like the notion, the hypotenuse of a triangle cannot be longer than its sides. The second, however, is not inherently impossible, but only from our perspective.
It's longer than any one side.
Either one.
But not...
Right. Both of them are both inherently impossible for the Rashba. You cannot have an hypotenuse shorter than one of the sides, or cannot be longer than both of the sides.
Because it's an inherent contradiction.
Right. Exactly.
So this is much of mathematics, can be used.
Exactly. Absolutely. The second, however, is not inherently impossible, but is only so from our perspective, due to our limited wisdom. We have not seen a rock exude water, or the sea temporarily split, and subsequently return to its normal state, or the sun and the moon remaining stationary and cease orbiting, or the sun regressing in its path. And all these things are, of course, miracles that take place in the Bible. The latter two is this example of Shemesh Begivon Dome, and the sun retracting in the story of Chizkiyahu and Yeshayahu, and other such things, including the resurrection of the dead. These things, however, are only impossible from our perspective, due to the limited wisdom of all creatures and their impotence with respect to altering the natural order. But for God, they are not impossible. He is indeed certainly able to do such things. For we may not ascribe any deficiency or lassitude to his strength and wisdom, since he and his wisdom are one, and we cannot understand his wisdom until we understand his essence. This is a quote, by the way, from my brother-in-law's translation, Rabbi Yitzchak Grossman. And he has an article on the topic of divine omnipotence, which is referred to here in the footnote number one.
Who's your brother-in-law?
Rabbi Yitzchak Grossman.
Oh, that's your brother-in-law.
Is
that's
he
my
brother-in-law.
No, he's written articles on Chakira.
Okay.
Okay. So this, again, is very similar to the position of the Rambam. And finally, lest you think that this was an ancient medieval idea, but one which has long since
dissipated,
there's a passage here from the Chazon Ish, of all people, who I believe assumes the very same idea. The Chazon Ish here is discussing the following, an interesting idea, and I'll only review it quickly because I want to get to the opposing positions. The Chazon Ish asks the following. There are some people who say, what have you proven when you say that God must exist? Because otherwise, what could account for all creation, for all existence? Because you're just pushing the can backwards a little bit, because then you'll ask, well, what could account for the existence of God? So he says, that's not a good question, because there are certain things, aval ein ledimyon bina, ki nimtza sheyesh lo mida v'ketzef orach v'shatach, anu mitzayrim b'da'atenu hedro v'chol hanimtzaim b'sug hazeh b'echreach sheyesh eit l'metziutam v'yesh lahem hatchala. V'chol sheyesh lo hatchala, yesh lo havaya, v'chol sheyesh lo havaya, yesh lo mehaveh. This is actually more or less a quote from Rabbeinu Bachya's Shar HaYichud, and in the Chovos HaVavos, and he says that when it comes to things that are physical, that have an end, or the like, so if they have an end, then they must have a beginning. And if they have a beginning, they must have a creator. And therefore, we can prove the existence of God from the fact that we exist, because there's a cause for our existence. What was the cause? You'll tell me our parents. Well, what was the cause for their existence and their existence going on and on and on backwards? What's the cause? What was the start? What was the beginning? There is a beginning, so there must be a cause of the beginning, and that cause is God. Aval yesh nimtzaim she'en lahem lo midah v'lo shetach. There are existences that have no physical dimensions, V'henim ta'im b'chiyuv. They exist because they necessarily exist. V'lo yitzuyar b'ham hadar, v'lo v'hena muskalot. We couldn't imagine their non-existence. Our existence, we could imagine our non-existence. But muskalot, we could not imagine their non-existence. Kimo, intellectual concepts or logical constructs. Kimo, bet pa'mim bet hem dalet. Like mathematics, 2 times 2 is 4. That reality does not exist in any physical sense, and therefore there's no reason to assume it never didn't exist. Ukimo amuskal shalachson odef al ha'orech. Like the idea that we said, that the diagonal is going to be longer than a side. Ukiyote bahen. Min amuskalot she'enu muskal musagim mimusagei guf ve'en lo eit lemetziuto ve'lo noldo me'olam. They never were created. They always simply existed. Ve'lo yamutu le'olam. They will never cease to exist. So his point is then that we can't, when it comes to God, God is not a physical thing. There's no end to existence, and therefore to say that he always existed is not problematic. Okay, so all of this that we've seen thus far, these three sources, the Rambam and Moreh Nevuchim, the Rashba and Tshuva, and the Chazon Ish, all assumed, or at least seemed to assume, that God, that there's such a thing as logic which exists independently of God. Now, you might not say it exists, but which is true, and therefore, to say that God is unable to violate logic is not problematic. It doesn't.
What does that mean, independent of God?
Okay, so maybe it's a bad way to say it.
It means nothing to do with God.
Right.
But before God created the universe, there was no such thing as two. What two?
The Chazon Ish is assuming.
What is a triangle and a hypotenuse?
There may be taking a certain perspective on mathematics. And indeed, this is one that happens to be debated among mathematicians. And I'm not in a perspective. I don't know enough to know about that. But I've seen a little bit of this question, which is, that's a good question. They're assuming that that's not true, that there was meaning to that statement even without any existence, even before the universe existed. Okay. Now,
but you see, even statements like you can't have a triangle that those angles don't make 180 degrees, that's in a certain context, like you're assuming a plane.
Okay.
If the triangle were on a sphere, that might not be true.
I agree.
So all these kind of qualifications that man has become more astute over the centuries. Who's to say that we know where that begins and where that ends?
Exactly.
We're making these absolute assertions
that
seem obvious to us, could at some later date be
exactly.
Wrong.
Exactly. So I'm very...
A Boolean geometry, which I don't know, but I know the terminology, might not agree with that axiom.
I agree. So now we're going to have the other perspective. And to me, and again, like what many of you are arguing, is this assumption seems to be very presumptuous. And one way of reflecting that is the following. We cannot relate to God's essence. We could only relate to him insofar as he relates to us or he manifests himself. One reflection of that is the Medrash, the second source on page 3. Vayomer Elokim al Moshe, Amrebi Abba Bar Mamel, Amrele HaKadosh Baruch Hu Moshe, Shmi Ata Mevakesh Leida, Moshe, you're asking to know my name? Lefi Ma'asai Ani Nikra, I am known by my actions. In other words, you can't ask my name. My actions are what I'm known by. Pa'amim shani nikra be'el shaddai, be'tzivaot, be'elohim, be'hashem. Kshani dan et habiyot, ani nikra elokim. When I judge creations, then I'm known as elokim. Kshani osem milchama b'rishaim, ani nikra tzivakot. Kshani tole et al chata'av shel adam, ani nikra el shaddai, etc., etc. What is this medrash telling us? This medrash is saying that I manifest myself differently at different times, and that is the only way in which you could relate to me. D'mor nevuchim, chelak aleph, simen samach aleph. Kol shemosav yis'ale hanimtzaim b'sfarim, kulam nigzarim min ha'pe'ulos. All the names that are written in the books come from his actions. V'zem ha'she'en ha'lembo el'ashem echad. V'hu yud K vav K. Shehu shem hamiyuchad lo yitala. Lezen nikra shem hamifurash. Inyano shu yore al atzmu yisale. Hora'a mivu eres ein hashutafuspa. Here the Rambam is distinguishing between the shem havaya and all other names. All other names relate to his actions. The shem havaya relates to his being. The Nefesh HaChaim writes, shar beis chelak beis. Amnam inyana bracha. Lo yisbarach shemo. Eina kavana latzmus adon yachid baruchu kaviyachol. Chalila v'chalila. When we refer to God, we don't refer to God's essence. Ki hu miromam me'al kol bracha. Because he is above any sort of bracha. Aval inyan kemo shekasav bezohar dekud shebirichu sachim v'galya.
What do those words mean, that he is above any kind of bracha?
When we refer to him in a bracha, that is, we are referring to him in the way we perceive him, but not his essence. He's going to explain. Ki atzmus ein sof baruch hu sasim mikos dimin. The essence of God, his ein sof, the infinite character of God, is something that is hidden absolutely. Ve'ein lekavanaso chas v'shalom b'shum shem klal. And he can't be limited. Sorry, ve'ein lechanoso chas v'shalom b'shum shem klal. He cannot be limited by any name. A name is a limitation, because a name is a description. And in reality, any name, therefore, is impossible with respect to his essence, with respect to the ein sof. Afilu b'shem havaya baruch hu. Even the name havaya, which is the highest of the names, is still false with respect to his true essence. Va'afilu b'kutzo shel yud debay. Va'af gam ma'ash b'zohar kadosh mechaneu yisbarach b'shem ein sof. And even the term which the Zohar uses to refer to this essence as ein sof, einenu kinui alav yitbarach shemo, that's not a description of God. Ela kavana al hasagasenu oso mitzad kochos hanishpa'im meito b'heschabruso b'rtzono laholamos ulezos kinehu kinuhu ein sof velo ein reishis. That's why we refer to him as ein sof. There's no end, as opposed to there's no beginning. Ki be'ames mitzad atzmuso yisbarach shemo ein lo sof velo reishis rak mitzad hasagasenu kochosav yisbarach halo. Kol hasagasenu hu rak reishis, aval ein sof lagia b'hasagas lehasig es kolchosav yisbarach hanishbayim. Uma shemusag etzlenu, ktsas, that little amount that we do understand, v'anu mechanim u'mitarim kama te'arim b'shemos v'chinuyim u'midos, and therefore we use all sorts of names to describe, kimo she matzinum b'torah u'v'chol matbeya hatfilah, kulam hem rak mitzad hischabruso yisborach el olamos. All those terms that we use to describe him are only terms that relate to his hischabros, his connection to us and to the worlds, v'akochos me'es habriah, from the beginning of creation. This is a mistake that people make. This is, of course, a Kabbalistic text, and people make when studying Kabbalah, they think that you're describing God and God is in some way physical. No. What the Nefesh HaChaim is saying, and many other Kabbalistic sources stress this. If you just look, for example, at the beginning of Sefer Tanya, or many, many sources, they stress this idea that we can't at all relate to God's essence. All we could do is relate to him insofar as he relates to us. So that being the case,
what I'm getting from this is that we can only apprehend God's essence or existence in terms of what our senses can apprehend.
There's nothing about God's essence that we can relate to.
And therefore, it's what God is beyond what our senses are capable of.
Correct. Sensing. And that includes our mind. And that being the case, so how could we possibly say that God is limited by logic if, after all, logic is something we made up And at best, it's something that we made up based off of our perception of the universe or him or the like. And therefore, as I said before, it's extraordinarily pretentious to say that God is somehow limited by logic. We made up logic. How could we limit God thereby? Now, at most we could say, well, it's conceivable that God is limited by logic. Or even if it is the case that God could not create a hypotenuse, which is shorter than one of the sides, that would not in any way imply deficiency. But not that that is the case.
No, it's a contradiction in terms. It's not a contradiction in God's capability.
Okay. One beautiful expression of this can be found in the Maharal's second introduction to Gevuras Hashem. The Maharal here is responding to philosophers who minimized Nisim. First, he notes that according to Aristotle, miracles are impossible, and then he notes that according to Jewish sources that try to minimize miracles, though they don't go that far, they are in their limitation of miracles. And it's specifically, he says that even though those Jewish thinkers who do this are motivated by noble intentions, because they argue that miracles imply a deficiency in God and that they imply that he changed his mind and his initial creation was somehow flawed and therefore it had to be altered. But this is absolutely wrong. And specifically, it's an attack on the Ralbag. Ralbag argued, and this could be found in his commentary to Joshua, chapter 10, in his commentary to Malachim Beis, chapter 20, as well as Milchamos Hashem, part 6, book 6, part 2, chapter 12, that God does not perform miracles concerning the celestial bodies, only in the sublunar world. Now, he does this because he had a certain Aristotelian conception of the universe, which need not concern us for now. But he basically said that the miracles, like Shemesh Begivon Dom, were impossible, and he interprets the psukim accordingly in a somewhat forced way.
When people talk about miracles, do they all have the same definition of what a miracle is?
Maybe not. For now, we'll assume it means a suspension of the laws of nature. Now, the Maharal rejects this.
So the same could be said for the parting of the sea.
You could have, but he doesn't.
But that's within the sublunar sphere.
Right, and that's why he said...
That doesn't bother Ralbag.
Within an Aristotelian conception of the universe, there's a difference. For us, it makes no difference. Anyhow, in his discussion of miracles, the Maharal considers a fascinating hypothesis, which he admits he's not sure about. But he wonders. Turn to page 5, the text at the bottom.
Page 5.
Amnam tsarich iyun. Im nase neis ze l'chol ha'olam, o lo nase neis ze rak be'ofek ahu. This miracle, namely Shemesh Begivon Dom, this suspension of the sun and the moon, did that happen everywhere? In other words, in the whole world did the sun stop? Or perhaps only in that horizon? Ki yesh lomar, perhaps, ki yoshul Yisrael be'ofek ahu haya midat ha'shemesh, for the Jewish people, at that point in time, the sun stood still. Ulchol olam lo amda shemesh. But for the rest of the world, the sun continued to move as normal. Maybe that's why you don't see it recorded anywhere.
It says in the bottom of the recording, it's Aristotelian perspective.
That's
so
going on.
About intellectual beings, it means that they were a product of our intellect.
No. Don't worry about that. It's a footnote going on an earlier point. Vilazeh yoter pela. Now, certainly, it is more remarkable to say the sun was both moving and not moving at the same time.
Yeah.
But that too, Moral Gvuras Hashem Yisbrach Neflosav, this would demonstrate the greatness of God. Vim Yomar, and if you ask, Eich Yitachen Davar Zeh Bitzior, how is it conceivable that the sun could be both moving and not moving at the same time? Ki Teilech Hashemesh V'Tamod V'Pamachas, Shezeu Be'atzmo Kimo Shekasav B'Ralbag, Sheim Shnei Afachim B'Nosei Achad, V'Lo Yitkabtzu Yachad. Right, it contradicts logic. Something cannot be both moving and moving at the same time. Kvar marnu shedvarav lo yitzdeku bezev. The Ralbag was wrong about that point. Ki efshar v'yuchal v'yachol lios shetelech Hashemesh mitzad inyanah hanahug v'tiyah midat la mitzad hanes. Mitzad ha-teva continues to move, and mitzad ha-nes, it's stationary. She'achol yot le-davar achad shnei dvarim hafachim mitzad shnei bechinot. From two perspectives, it could have two opposite things happening simultaneously. Va-teva davar miuchad v'shalo b'teva davar miuchad. Ki ein safek ki malat ha-nes ha-bilti tivi hu yoter b'ma'ala u'v'madrega min ha-teva. ומפני שהם שתי מדרגוס, מסחפוס, הנה עשה שמס בשני בחינוס, כפי חילוף המדרגוס, תלך מצד הטבע ותעמוד בלתי טבעי, כי כשם שראוי שתלך מצד הטבע, כך יש בחינה שכלית שבאמצע השמיים יש לה מידה. And he continues. So the basic idea is again, he develops it a little more complexly, but the basic point is that the sun was both standing still, mitzad hanes, and moving, mitzad hatava. For the Jews, it was standing still. For the rest of the world, it was mitzad hatava. And
that was like analogous to one of the makos that affected only.
Perhaps. That's a great analogy, and we're going to see that later.
It's also analogous a little bit to relativity theory.
Yes, we're going to get there. We're running out of time, but I want to get there. So let's just try to move a little quickly. Look at the underlined on page 6. Amru asara nisim nasu lavosenu beveis hamikdash. There were 10 miracles in the Beis Hamikdash. One of them was omdim tzfufim umishtachavim revachim. That means that everybody gathered in. They were standing. It was packed, and when it was time to bow, there was room for everybody. Vine gam bedavar zehu nimna mefilosofim. The philosophers were very bothered by this but the answer is as we said, right? And he gives numerous examples to this idea. One that comes to mind, I don't recall that he said it, is the concept of makom aron eno min aminyan. It's a Gemara in Megillah, Yud Amud Beis. The aron didn't take up space. In other words, because when you count the space, there wasn't room for it. Reb Tzadok writes this in a fascinating essay on page 7. He writes about the contradiction between divine foreknowledge and free will, and he entertains the possibility, he offers an interpretation of the Rambam of a similar thing. Yes, it might indeed be a logical contradiction. There might be a logical contradiction between foreknowledge and free will, but that is not a problem, because that's what we mean. That's what the Rambam meant when he said divine knowledge is not like our knowledge. We can't comprehend it. And the possibilities of what's possible in that realm is different than for us. In Rabbeinu Gershom Chanuch Henoch Videbsky, which is a student of the same school of thought as Reb Tzadok from the Ishbitz school, he writes, Tzarich Adam Lamin Bemuna Shlema She'en Shum Mea Borei V'gam data adam hi tamid biyat Hashem yisbarach. Shekemo she'anu b'seichel hazeh v'yidiyatenu v'asagatenu hazot, she'yev sher l'shnei hafachim b'nosei achad. Even though from our perspective, from our logic, two things, opposite things cannot happen simultaneously, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu could do that. And he could make 1 + 1 not equal 2. All these are constructs of our mind. Al-Sheikh says a similar idea. Now I'd like to bring up a point that you all mentioned, which is, this relates to relativity. So there's a beautiful work by the Rav called The Halachic Mind.
Yeah.
And it's actually one of the most difficult of the Rav's works. It's quite esoteric and philosophical. But he begins the work with the following sentence, bottom of page 7. It would be difficult to distinguish an epoch in the history of philosophy more amenable to the meditating homo religiosus than that of today. And his basic point is that for centuries, until the 20th century more or less, science and philosophy walked hand in hand, assuming that there was a single construct in terms of the way in the world exists, and science, and there were fixed laws, perspective was irrelevant. This was true in Aristotelian physics and Newtonian physics and the like. And all that has changed. In the 20th century, we've discovered that things are really far more complex. As he writes, again, top of page 8, philosophy remained the satellite of science until the beginning of the 20th century. Both Aristotle and Newton adopted a scientifically purified world as the subject matter of their bodies. There's a great essay on this, on the work of called Halachic Mind, which sort of summarize it and distills it in much plainer English by Dr. William Kohlbrenner, which is referred to in the bottom of page 8. Quantum physics rescued the philosopher of religion from his slavish attachment to the objectivity of Newtonian science. Essentially, according to quantum physics, there was no rationally ordered objective world, and there was no methodological objectivity. Now, I'm not an expert on this topic by any means, but that's essentially the work of the Rav, and he talked about how this totally changed religious philosophy. If it's possible for an electron to have both properties of a wave and a particle, even though those two things are seemingly contradictory, then it's certainly possible for the sun to move and not to move, and so on and so forth. We no longer need to be limited by this objective reality, which so much bound the medieval philosophers. This also is very relevant when we understand the idea of Eluv Elu Divrei Elokim Chaim. Maybe another time we could return to that point. But that being the case, so I think that from this perspective, this idea that we saw in the Hasidic thought and the like, that both something can exist and not exist and the like, takes on a whole new meaning. And really, it changes our perspective. So it's a topic we could spend much more time on, but as I said, Motzei Shabbos, I was thinking about it, and it really is, it's really remarkable. All right, I'll pick up, God willing, next week. Wonderful Shabbos. Last week was the fifth installment of Ikrei Emunah. So it's on the web. If you'd like to, on YUTorah.com.